Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm joined by the best-selling author and Vogue columnist Raven Smith, who's been hailed as the funniest man on Instagram and dubbed London's fashion world philosopher. His first book, Raven Smith's Trivial Pursuits, captured readers as a witty and irreverent guide to modern life. And he's back with a new book, part memoir, part commentary on masculinity, called Raven Smith's Men. As you'll soon hear, Raven is also an avid traveller and has written for numerous travel titles about his experiences around the world. He takes us from the pyramids of Egypt to the nightclubs of New York, from Greek island tavernas to the hidden beaches of Barbados, with lots of laughs along the way. So fasten your seatbelts, let's get started. Raven Smith, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. It's so great to meet you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I've come through, what is it? I've gone through the airport and we're taking off.
We are taking off on a journey through the seven chapters of your life.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Excited. It's like the seven hills of Rome.
There you go. I mean, reading a lot of your work, it's safe to say that you are a keen traveler, right?
Oh, I adore it. You know, I love new things, new experiences, new people, new chat, new sights, new sounds, new flavours. So travelling means the world to me. I am a bit of a London obsessive. I love London so much. So there's this feeling of like going away and coming back to London. It's just like the best thing in the world.
So actually going away, the new sights and smells is exciting. But then also you love London so much that the end of the holiday isn't so bad, right?
It's always, there's always that fit, that kind of like pit of the stomach sadness on the last day of a holiday. A mini break, it's not so bad. But like if you're on a 2-week jaunt, that feeling of knowing you have to leave is not nice. But I love coming back to London. So I never feel too sad for too long.
Do you ever do that thing on a long holiday that when you're having a really good time where when it's like 5 days before you have to go back, you're like, oh, I've only got five more nights left. I've only got four more nights. I count them down in my head and I'm like trying to like eke out every
moment. It's been so long since I've done a proper 2-weeker when you start to like not know what day it is, but like between Christmas and New Year. I haven't really been like unplugged and feral for quite a while. But I am hoping for that soon.
No, me either. I haven't done that since pre-COVID.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we did the right thing by sitting about.
Where was the first place that you visited when we could travel again? Did you go on a mini break anywhere abroad?
I made it to Crete for 4 nights.
Crete, that's in your book that we'll come on to in a bit.
Crete, that's in my book. I wrote about it in my book.
Yeah,
I was there, right? Yeah. So I wrote about it after I got back. I was there for 4 or 5 nights, and they shut down Greece the day after I flew home. I mean, I've been so unbelievably fluky in the country shuts up as I take off.
What are you bringing to the country, Raven?
Nothing. Well, they shut down everywhere that could fly back to the UK, the Greek islands, and Crete just shut as I left. But while I was there, it was gorgeous.
I have never been to Crete. I'd love to go. Is it beautiful?
I was a little bit naughty. I was on quite a gorgy little package. So they picked me up from the airport, took me to the hotel, and there were, you know, 6 restaurants, 5 pools,
nice.
The beach, the cove. So it was very kind of contained, great for families, which I don't have. I was on my own. and I went to Crete once with some gal pals, about 7 of us all together, and we went for a week, and my friend killed a kitten. We first over it, which really put the dampeners on the fun. Not enough ouzo to kind of get over the murder of a cat.
Oh my god.
She better, when I press, when I do press about this podcast, I'm going to block her so she doesn't have to relive it.
I don't think I can press you on the details because I'm a massive cat lover and you're a cat lover too, right?
I am an absolute cat lover and it was trauma for everyone involved. We came back and I said to her boyfriend, oh, what about that cat? And he's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, right, yeah, what am I talking about? What happened?
It didn't happen.
Gals on holiday, just Lidos and loads of boobs. I mean, a lot of boobs when you go on holiday with loads of women.
This is true. Right, well, we're going to go back to the very beginning of your life.
Yeah.
Chapter one of your travel diaries is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Okay, so I feel like I'm cheating a little bit because I grew up like relatively not rich, essentially poor, and we didn't really do a lot of like international travel. I vaguely remember going to Dieppe with my mum and staying in like a holiday camp of tents, but it's so vague. And the first time I remember being on a plane, I was 11, so it was after primary school. My mum booked us on 2 weeks on COS, and I was so anxious about getting on a plane. I remember being sick at the airport before we flew. Yeah, like really, like, because I always got quite funny about getting too hot. I can't explain. That was the past. It's the opposite of who I am now. And people kept saying, it's a different kind of heat. And I was like, it's a different kind of heat. I remember feeling very worried about some kind of like shriveling to a raisin as we flew. But I got the taste for Greece almost immediately. There's something about just the way of life that just struck a chord with me. And it was my first real sort of beach holiday where it was like, nothing to do in the day, little bit of lunch, little bit of dinner. I remember drinking peach juice and thinking it was like the most exotic thing that had ever happened to me in my whole life. And it was magic. And I think I've never quite gotten over, not that I'd want to get over my love for Greece, but it's never quite out of my system. Always want a bit more.
Well, the thing is that, I mean, you don't, as you say, you don't really ever have to get over it because you could go to a different island for every holiday, probably for the rest of your life. And you could go to a new one, because there are so many. It's just so vast.
We went to Milos a couple of summers ago, loved it to pieces. And then I was like, do we go back or do we try and do something new?
So what was Milos like?
Gorgeous. So we flew to Athens and then flew to Milos. So it has its own little airport from the mainland, which means it's not too bad to get to, no boats. And it's quite sort of tear the plaster off, wake up the next day on a little tiny little Greek island.
Yeah.
It's quite barren and dusty, but the food is just phenomenal. It's like a real culinary, a kind of forgotten culinary gem, apparently. But I just remember eating like sort of like goat's cheesy omelette with courgettes, and they have this place called like O Hamos, and it's just delicious. We went like three times in a week.
Really?
I think this, people are so weird when they go on holiday that they don't like going to the same place for dinner twice, and I'm like, no, when you find somewhere that's delicious, just keep going.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, actually. Like, and then that particular spot then takes a real special place in your heart as well.
Yeah, totally. We loved it. We went right before the airport, then flew, you know, a little dip in the sea and then flew home.
Okay. I need to add Milos to my Greek island wish list.
I keep doing those tests, which Greek island are you? And I keep getting a different one every time.
I didn't know that they existed. So which ones are you getting?
Oh, they're everywhere. Well, I think I keep wanting to go to, I feel like I once swam to that shipwreck that's on the beach, the oil tanker, and left a pair of flip-flops there. So I remember that quite vividly. Me and my mum love COS, so I wonder if that would be a good one to go back to. We went down to the Peloponnese like 1 October and it was still quite warm.
Mm. Well, growing up in Brighton, I mean, that is an area that's really popular with British travellers.
Mm.
And just the international travellers in general. I mean, it's a really hot tourist spot. I mean, at the time when you were living there, as a child? Did you see the appeal? I mean, like, did you get it then and did you love it?
I outgrew it. I can't think of a better way to describe it. And I don't know if everyone grows out of where they grew up. So I loved being what I would think of as a big fish in a small pond. When I got to 17 and I was swaggering around listening to the Libertines and acting like I owned the place, because it's like six main streets, like it's quite easy to do. But I felt like I just transcended living there. But I loved it. What did I love about it? I think the thing I love about Brighton is, yes, it's multicultural and yes, it's quite liberal, but there's something really magical about cities by the sea. Like I am addicted to them. Barcelona, wherever, I just have, they hold such a special space in my heart, to just have this kind of big infrastructure churning movement, and then also just have the ocean or the channel or whatever at your disposal. I just love it, and I'll never quite get over that mix of the two. I just find it really nourishing in a way.
Oh my god, me too. You and I are kindred spirits,
okay,
because
good.
It's like my dream is to live somewhere like that. I mean, I used to live near the Thames, and that kind of gave me a little bit, like it satiated my appetite a little bit.
Yeah,
but yeah, like those cities by the water, like Barcelona is a prime example.
Yeah,
to have that sexy beach,
yeah,
like right there.
Yeah,
it's just, they're so lucky.
It's really
they're
special.
So
yeah, I love it.
Yeah. So chapter two is the first place that you fell in love with.
I think the one thing that I really loved in kind of the last 5 years was when I went to Japan. I was there for 72 hours. And I can tell you, you don't get jet lag if you refuse to sleep at all. And you're just like, we're just staying up. Tokyo is kind of built to entertain you all night. You know, those karaoke bars do not close. And it was a real sort of amuse-bouche for a country, an island that feels just really special. I was like, oh, this is really, really special. This is like nothing I've ever experienced in my whole life. I loved it. And I feel like it's the one that got away, because I was there so briefly. I feel like I'm in love with it, but it's like meeting someone on a platform and then going off on a train. I'm like, I want more. I was on like a little press trip, and I would say, wherever you travel, you should go to McDonald's and try the local delicacies wherever we are on the planet. So I went to the Japanese
McDonald's.
No one's
ever said that before.
Yeah, but I mean, in Milan, it is bananas. But in Japan, it was like green Fanta and carbonara fries. And it was like, it's like a romp through kind of almost, but it is the one that got away. I think of it all the time. It's too much. And it's nonstop. And I was like, this is for me. I wanted to talk more about beaches. I've lost so many beaches, too many to mention. The first place Richard and I, my husband, went together was Barbados. It was our first long haul holiday, and nothing feels more on holiday than a 50p rum and coke.
In fact, it's actually been quite divisive on the podcast. Some people have found it a bit like Brits abroady. I think it depends on where you go.
Totally. So we read something in The Guardian that was like 100 best places to stay under £100 a night. This was maybe 10, 12 years ago. We stayed in a place called CU Guest House on the north side. So you're on the Atlantic. It's really choppy, loads of surfers, which is great. And then that south side, the Caribbean side, is much more like hotel, motel, Holiday Inn. It's much more kind of structured around moneyed tourists. I don't know what we were reading, but you can find secret beaches between the big hotel beaches. So we were, and I just remember the first day, the sun is like midway going down, walking down this path between the, like, all this, you know, exotic tropical bracken and coming out on the Caribbean Sea and just being like, this is legitimately paradise. This is what everyone is talking about when they say it's paradise. I couldn't take it in. I was just like, I can't believe how beautiful this is. So we were there, I mean, I, and I, because it's tiny, it's easy to get around. We were just in our element, just mooching around.
And really romantic, the first long haul trip you've taken together as well.
Yeah, and just staying in this kind of little squat sort of, it reminded me of like Mississippi housing. Like it's like just little white squatty house and just, you know, my husband getting burnt to a cinder and me having a lovely time.
Well, let's continue actually the chat about beaches, because yes, you actually have some chapters in your new book, Ravensmith's Men, that are named after destinations in the world. One of them being Newquay.
Yes.
From Barbados to Newquay.
I mean, Newquay, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you want to tell us a little bit about that chapter? And it's a real coming of age story.
Okay. Where do we start with the Newquay story? When I was 16, like a lot of people post GCSE, I went to Newquay with a load of my mates.
Rite of passage.
Rite of passage. What do I remember about that trip that doesn't jump us straight into the embarrassing story? I think a lot of my book focuses on being on the cusp of adulthood and this feeling of like, I'm not quite an adult until I do this or this or whatever. So circling the plug hole of being a young man and becoming a kind of young adult. And I think this chapter was, I met a boy in a club. We were kissing. We went out onto the beach. Stuff was going to happen. And I was afraid. Do I need to tell you that?
And to find out more, listeners, you need to buy Raven's book, Ravensmith's Men, because it gets even better.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I was afraid in my adulthood is coming over the hill and I needed a get out clause.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was both like funny, but also like quite sweet.
Yes. My editor said it was sweet and I was like, cool. It's one of the most embarrassing things that's ever happened to me.
Okay, so good. The book is part memoir and part commentary on masculinity.
Yeah.
Like, what was the reason that you wanted to write it? What was the inspiration behind it?
So about 3 months into the pandemic, I was sitting at home into lockdown. So about May, June time, I was feeling inundated with memories of my past. I'm not sure a lot of people were sitting alone with their feelings or with their families and their feelings and their thoughts. And I was just really aware of how often those memories were connected to masculinity in some way. And I wanted to write a book of funny anecdotes of my liaisons with men, whether they are sexual or friendly or work or family. And I think what it developed into was masculinity kind of penetrates, for want of a better word, so much of what we do and so much of the life that I've had. And I'm a gay man who fancies men, I'm a gay man of what I understand is a gay man who fancies men of what I understand is a man, which is very different to a lot of how Gen Z are viewing things. I'm happy to be a relic of literally 3 years ago. So I wanted to tell good stories of things I remembered, but I can't shake that thing of like how men have been integral to how I remember stuff. So I just tried to put that out there. I think I would never be able to write pop psychology on the way men operate, but I can be like, this is a man that I saw doing this. This is the man that I thought I was at the time. This is the man that I was felt. This is how my masculinity changed after some of these experiences.
Yeah. I mean, like in terms of observation of masculine culture, given that we're going on a kind of jaunt around the world,
yes,
is there a kind of a place where the men intrigued you the most?
Oh, good question. I don't think I've ever thought about it like that. But then there is part of me which is like, the thing is, me and my husband have this conversation where he says he doesn't have a type and I say I don't have a type, and we're very cool about not delving too deeply into that. But there is this sort of recurring theme in the kind of men that I get obsessed and head over heels with, and that's sort of like Spain and Greece is where I'm getting a bit like, oh, I feel a little bit, I'm getting a bit giddy. So I would say very intrigued by Spanish men. That sounds very shallow. Okay.
No. I'm not surprised about the Greece thing because, you know, yeah. One of the parts of your book when you're talking, kind of you're reflecting on actually where you're writing and you're observing, you know, the Speedo wearing men from the safety of your, the Speedo gussets, actually, of your sun lounger. So I love that.
There's something about the beach that I find so brilliant, not even necessarily that turns me on, but it's like the idea that it is the most public place you can be, loads of you on this strip of sand or stones, but you are dressed like you are only with the people you love. It's so weird.
It's so weird. You're so right. And
the private public thing is complete. The context is so crucial to that whole thing.
Yeah. It's great. It's so true. Although I wonder now, I mean, that I think definitely was a case. Now I wonder if it actually has been like so normalized because of, you know, Love Island, etc. And like Insta fitness. Like
yeah.
When I was growing up, like fitness and like body consciousness just wasn't the same as it is now. It's like really ramped up to a new level where I think like being hot physically has really gone up in the stakes.
Yeah. I wonder if when we were growing up, like the only time we saw loads of bodies was at the beach. And now it's like, you can't escape.
Yeah, now we're inundated.
Yes.
Now we're inundated, exactly. So actually, maybe the younger people, maybe they're less interested in other people's bodies on the beach. Maybe we're the ones that are like...
we're like, what a vintage analog titillation. And they're like, I have a phone.
Exactly. Okay, chapter three.
Yes.
The place where you learned the most about yourself. Where would that be?
I'm going to say Berlin. Because when I was finished university or midway through my university, I went there for a week on my own. Because I had nothing else to do. I've been working all summer and I was going back into my third year. And it taught me so much. Traveling on your own is just completely different to anything else. I'd always had someone thinking about my passport or something. Someone else was helping me in some way. So I guess the pressure to travel on your own, the amazing experiences you can have traveling on your own, the pressure it puts on you to be with other people and to make bonds with strangers, which I just thought was brilliant. Like I did tell a lot of lies. I was like, I could be anybody. But I think I learned to just not be shy, be less shy. I've never been that shy. And then just Berlin is so kind of what I realized was it's like, it's so kind of brutal to look at and so sort of ugly on the outside and warm on the inside. People are so nice there. And I think, you know, some other cities are the opposite. So I just found it really welcoming. And I returned when I got my contract for my first book. I went back there as somewhere I knew I could be alone and be content. And I lived there for a month writing the first draft of my first book. Yeah. And I was just waking up, walking for 2 hours and writing and just, you know, eating pumpernickel bread and like loving it, really. It's just got, I think the way of life, I think there's an assumption that it's like party, but actually the people that don't party have a delicious way of life. They're like they're really looked after communally and governmentally. You really feel it there, that people are content.
What neighborhood did you stay in?
I was in Nykholm, but actually by total chance, someone I knew was moving out or was renting, and it was like a couple of £100 to stay there for the month. I mean, it was just like, it was perfect.
Do you have any like go-to spots that you went to like all
the
time?
No, I literally delivered food and typed all night, like Mary Nightingale. Yeah, I was like, let's keep the, I was really, really focused. It's the only way I find it's possible for me to write. And now they've got rid of delivery because it's a little bit, whatever the bureaucracy of it, they decided, Berlin's decided they don't need it. So you can't, I went there for this next book and I was like, I'm going to starve. I had to go to the supermarket, which was completely fine.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Is New York going to come as one of your chapter destinations?
I moved to New York for 90 days on a tourist visa after I finished university. And I fell head over heels in love with it. I get quite sort of homesick for it. It feeds my soul. That's very, very grandiose thing to say, but there's something about just being there. It's not about where you're going, who you've seen. It's just the atmosphere of like, nourishing. I've said nourishing already, but like, it does something to me that makes me feel inspired and energized and excited, and you know, like real recharging my battery.
I really related to something that you wrote, which I wrote down in that chapter, where you said being British in New York is its own personality. Britishness makes you shiny like a tuppence. People think you're special. The novelty of it is crack for non-Native Americans whose history started in like the 1800s.
Yeah.
Made me laugh so much as the daughter actually of a New Yorker. Because, you know, even for me, when I'd go over there, even my name, Holly, they'd think was crazy.
Yeah.
Because they'd call it like Holly, right?
So Of course.
Holly. Oh my God. Holly.
Yeah.
It is wild how obsessed they are with Britishness. Isn't it?
It's brilliant. You can get away with absolute murder. I was so plummy when I was there. I was like 21. And I was like, hello. All right. Hello. Like, I really played into it. I think I just find it is interesting how hard communication can be when we essentially share a language. I think what you're saying about Holly, I had a friend called Walter and they were like, what are you saying? They're like, it's Waller. Wilder. Walter.
The other name that I find really strange is Graham there, because they say Graham. Graham.
So we were the L train going into Bushwick where we were living, and it was the grand stop and the Graham stop. And it was like Graham. I was like, no, these are different words. It's something about New York, the fact that it is constantly evolving and that it hits the rivers on each side and it can't spread out is so interesting. It's just going up. It's just like getting thicker and thicker and more concentrated. I just love that. You know, when I was there...
You lived in Manhattan, right? And then in Brooklyn.
I lived in my... I met a guy in a lock-in in a pub. And I was like, I'm moving to New York next week. And he's like, I live there. You can sleep on my sofa. And I slept on the sofa for a month. Amazing. I would never... imagine doing that now. Yeah. So like, what do you mean you've got nowhere to stay? And I was like, yeah, I just met this guy. And on the way there, he texted me to be like, don't say my name when you enter the country. And I was like, okay.
Oh, my God. What? But did you ever find out why?
No, I just said, thank you for having me for a month. made my sofa bed and vamooshed. I was out of there. No, I mean, I think there is something about sort of being 21 and being rootless that is totally, I was totally fine with. Oh, like, what a rootless existence. Let's go. Like, it was cool. Now I'd be like, well, I need to know where that next hot shower is coming from.
I really envied reading that chapter, actually, because there was such a sense of like liberation, free spiritedness that like, I don't think like I've certainly never like had a taste of that.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool to have had that kind of experience.
It was brilliant. I mean, I just, you know, I was very kind of rip it up and start again. I just wasn't that bothered about putting any lines in the sand, building any foundations of anything. I was just having fun, and it was built for, you know, party boys, party monsters, night owls. It was built for that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think obviously, as someone who loves a dance, loves going out all the time, you can self-pathologize. Self-pathology is a hell of a drug. I can tell myself that like partying all the time is part of this lineage of Studio 54 and the Romans, and then you're just like, or I'm a narcissist and a show-off and I love dancing in a big group. Like, it's like both of those things at once. Am I part of this great lineage, or am I just another, you know, guy on gin and tonics? I don't know. Well,
the lineage, Raymond.
Is it something we tell ourselves so we can keep going that dance?
So, obviously, you love New York. Chapter 4 is your all-time favourite destination.
Yes.
Where have you picked for that?
It's not New York. It's actually Cairo. So we, when I'm talking about my first book a lot, but as part of working on it, that I found very taxing and like grueling.
I'll plug your first book, by the way.
Raymond Smith's Trivial Pursuits, available in all good bookshops. I needed to have a big treat at the end, and and my dream has always been to go to Egypt and see the pyramids. Very, both brilliant and basic desire of mine, travel wise. And so we objectively went to see the pyramids and the tombs. And then we were going to this place called Siwa. It's a place called Siwa, which is like a little schlep out. And it's kind of like a 40-room eco lodge, no electricity. Like, it's like sandcastles built on the side of a salt lake. And it has, they bake the salt into like glass bricks. So some of the walls are like see-through salt bricks. It's brilliant. It was Princess Diana's favorite retreat. It was all very like, I spoke to two
people. Oh, I'd never heard of it. Yeah, it sounds amazing.
I spoke to two people who'd been to Egypt, and they were like, you should go here. It's expensive, but it's worth it. And it's like staying, when they say expensive, it's like a night at the Ritz, but this is nothing like a night at the Ritz, right? So you're like, you're just walking around with candles in the desert, and they're bringing out all these Egyptian feast foods, you know. It was amazing. The swimming pool had like a deep hole at the end. I was like, that's so weird. And apparently it's basically a well. So they take the water out of the pool and feed all the vegetation, and the pool just fills back up again. I mean, it was beautiful and amazing and haunting. And I was so into going to this place, but actually it was Cairo that was like, I get preoccupied about holiday destinations when I'm like, oh, I could live here. That it feels really like magical when you feel that. And Cairo is such a sort of dirty, sandy, the Sahara is just blowing in, it's noisy, it's sweaty, it's like, it's not built for like tranquility. My experience was not tranquil. The traffic, I've never seen anything like it in my whole life. And I just completely fell in love. I was like, this is mayhem. I love this chaos. And it's not like there's no rich people. There's just like in more gated communities. I mean, it's not like there's no gentrification, but it doesn't have like a trendy food scene yet. It's kind of like, it's still cooking. And I love that it wasn't finished. I love that. Yeah, and then of course you drive for 2 hours and you're inside a pyramid and it's like, whoa. I mean, phenomenal. I mean, real Indiana Jones stuff, crawling up the Great Pyramid was amazing.
So I haven't been to Egypt. Somewhere actually I've always wanted to go to. So did you, because sometimes you fly from Cairo to Luxor to see other stuff. So could you see quite a lot from being based in Cairo?
Yeah, well, we were there for like just shy of 2 weeks. And so we flew to Cairo, we were there for a few days. We went all the way to Aswan Dam. So we went all the way to Aswan Dam, which is an amazing kind of feat of engineering. We stayed in the old Cataract Hotel, which is in Death on the Nile. So I was very taken with that. Agatha Christie basically lived there for like 3 years writing, because that's how you traveled then. You didn't go for 10 days. And then we got the night train back to Cairo, which was just like, there's nothing I love more than a night train. I just think of it as the most romantic, cool, bustling thing. And obviously it's like the worst night's sleep of your life every time. Yeah. But I don't care. I'm just like, this is magic. You know, just like going for a wee, but you're just weeing out onto the track. It's just like you can see the ground speeding underneath the loo. It's like, it's just insane. So I love that. And we didn't do the Valley of the Kings. So that is the big kind of middle bit. And they don't run boats back to from there. You have to fly, or because there's a lot of sand pirates that siege boats just outside of Cairo. I was like, oh, we just go straight on the boat out of Cairo. And they're like, no, don't do that. That's not safe. I loved it. I would thoroughly recommend it. People don't know how they did the pyramids. I mean, you had slaves, but it's just a block of the pyramid is like large. I could barely climb one.
Unfathomable.
It is crazy. I mean, the only disappointment is it's baking hot. You agree to go up inside the pyramid, so you're crawling up this like tunnel. It's got lights and strips of wood, so it's a bit like a hamster's wheel, but it's not spinning. You go up and up and up in the heat of the day, and you get into this massive cavern, and it's completely empty. It's all in the British Museum. And there's nothing in there. I was like, right, Finders Keepers Museum got this. they were here first. But still amazing. Still just like this kind of built out of kind of human belief in afterlife. It's just brilliant.
We'll return to the podcast in a moment, but first I'm joined by my husband, Alex, who's making his debut on the podcast. We're here to have a chat about our experiences with Airbnb. Welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Thanks. Thanks for finally having me. I'm truly honored.
You know, I typed my name into Google. Can you admit that you typed your name into Google?
I have.
I typed my name into Google the other day for professional reasons, of course. And I saw the autofill thing that comes up says Holly Rubinstein husband. So there's a...
It doesn't.
Yeah, there's a degree of curiosity
wow.
around your identity.
The people have spoken.
And do you want to tell us, Alex, where we are recording from, because we're on location in a lovely Airbnb as we speak.
We are in West Sussex. We are about 2 miles down a private road, and we are in a converted farmhouse looking out over the most incredible estuary and coastal setting. We are just a stone's throw from the most amazing pub that you have to walk across the estuary to get to. And it really couldn't be more remote and more calming, really.
Yeah. And what we're getting a taste of is this real shift that we're seeing throughout travel of living anywhere. Brian Chesky, the founder and CEO of Airbnb, actually talked about this last season. He was my season finale guest on the podcast. And he really sold this notion that you and I have always been really tempted by of living and working in a different environment.
Yeah, he did. I loved that part of the episode. It was fascinating. I think he talked about as kind of the term hybrid travel, where you go for short or long periods of time, and in that time you aren't just traveling, you're working and you're kind of relocating to a whole new place, and you almost become like a local when you're there, rather than dipping into a location and just being the tourist. If you stay somewhere for 2 or 3 weeks and you're doing a bit of working and a bit of traveling, you kind of experience it in a different way. And I guess this is kind of a little snapshot of that.
Exactly. And this is, you know, this is one of the positive outcomes of COVID, because you're not tethered to your desk at the office anymore, and neither am I.
No. I mean, companies left, right and centre are allowing remote working. So this is going to be a thing for the future.
I can't wait for that.
Absolutely. We've been talking about it since we first met.
Yeah. And it brings back great memories of our 7 years hosting on Airbnb ourselves, because we were super hosts. We rented out our flat in central London, and we had a really great experience, didn't we, from start to finish?
We did. I mean, I remember the first period, which is probably just before I met you. And at that time, I was just renting out a spare room in the flat rather than the entire place. And it was an incredible year or two, because we had people from all over the world come and stay with us. And it was great to see them experiencing London for the first time, many of them. But as a result, through kind of being the hosts for them, telling them where to go, you ended up meeting people from all over the world. And I'm still in touch with people from Japan, from Sweden, from Brazil, from all over the world. And it was an incredible experience.
That's so cool. And then when I moved in, we ended up renting out the entire flat, and that helped to subsidize
it did.
Our travels.
Many flights were paid for because of the money from Airbnb.
And we had one particularly memorable family come and stay with us, didn't we?
We did. It was a father and son from Colorado. And I never forget receiving their feedback, which was the most glowing feedback. They must have had the trip of a lifetime in London.
Yeah.
And I remember they said to us, if ever you're in the Colorado area, come and stay at our Airbnb in a place called Marble, Colorado. I think they were a little bit surprised, because it probably was one of those off-the-cuff kind of comments, and it so happened we were genuinely traveling along that stretch of the Rockies only a few months later. But they were amazing. They loved us staying, and we absolutely would never have stayed in this sleepy mining village. I mean, it's called Marble, Colorado for a reason.
Yeah, big hunks of marble everywhere.
Yeah. And the views were just spectacular. I remember when we pulled up, and
it was an off-the-grid property, wasn't it?
The title was like Eco Off-the-Grid Cabin in Colorado.
There are a lot more off-the-grid properties on the Airbnb site, I think, since we went as well. It's become a real focus for them.
I remember arriving, and it was a bumpy, bumpy road to get there. But then this cabin was brand new, all solar-powered, and the views, there was no house in sight. And the views over this lake, looking out over snow-capped mountains, and we just sat on that veranda looking out over the sunset.
With binoculars looking out for like grizzly bears.
Well, no, we didn't see any grizzlies. I think we ended up seeing some smaller animals.
Yeah, it was a really wonderful experience, and wouldn't have come about had we not had that like human connection.
Absolutely.
And communication
not.
That you get through hosting and being a guest on Airbnb. So if you're tempted to become a prospective host yourself, you can learn more about how much you can earn sharing your space through the What's My Place Worth tool. And whether you're looking to live anywhere or become a host yourself, visit Airbnb and find out more. You won't regret it, will you, Alex?
Absolutely not.
So chapter 5 is your hidden gem, a place that you love that maybe my listeners might not know so much about.
Yeah, I found this quite hard, because in this day and age, is anything hidden anymore? I've felt very like, oh no, wait, what are the kind of places that I go or that I love that no one knows about? But whenever I see someone's in Paris, I tell them to go to L'Avant Comptoir de la Mer. Please tell me you haven't heard of it.
I've never heard of it. Tell me all about it.
So it's like a little, there's a kind of main restaurant, and then to the side of that, they have like butcher's like strip of curtains with a pig on it. And you go through these kind of plastic curtains, and it's basically an aluminium clad bar and like a little bench. And there's loads of placards hanging down from the ceiling with the menu on. So each one is a dish. They have this, you basically just sit, stand, have a Beaujolais, And do they bring you like small plates to eat? And it's just a total vibe. It's just like, oh, this is magic.
So cool.
On the counter, they have like this mountain of butter with loads of knives in. You just go in and, you know, excavate yourself some dairy. But it just has that feeling of like, it's not, I think there's loads of great little brasseries in Paris that, you know, they thrive on it and they're brilliant. And I love going to Brasserie Lip and having a steak, even though I don't eat meat, I'm not having a steak tonight. So I love all of that. But there's something about L'Avant-Comptoir that is just feels special. And like, because you can only fit like eight people in there, it always feels like quite a, you know, they'll do you a good wine. They look after
That's
you.
A perfect hidden gem.
Okay,
a perfect
good.
Hidden gem. And we can't kind of go on to the next chapter really without asking about your kind of favorite spots in London, because like you Ooh. Mentioned at the start, you know, you love London, you've written a lot about London.
Yeah.
Like, what, where are your, if someone was coming to visit you in London,
such a good question,
where would you say that they, where would be the, like the three places you'd say they had to go?
I always say Brasserie Zadel, but they've just sold it. The owner has just lost
it.
Oh yeah. So I don't know.
But do you think it will stay as Brasserie Zadel, or do you think it will change?
I feel like that, I mean, I don't know.
Because this is also like the Wolseley. And
I know. All my,
so sad.
All those like sort of no-brainer places where you will send someone and be like, you're going to have a great time at Zadel. Someone's like, it's my birthday, or my mum's in town, or it's my niece's christening. I'm like, you just go to Zadel. Yeah. They'll look after you.
Yeah.
It feels expensive, but it's not as expensive as the other ones. It's like, it's a vibe. Yeah. So hopefully that it will keep that vibe. I would always say go to Rochelle Canteen. I got married there, so I am biased. But I think it just gives good fare. It's like delicious. I always have, you know, I am not a fussy eater, but I like fish and I like sauce, and they always have a fish and sauce that is like chef's kiss, exactly what I want.
Yeah.
And with COVID, they have built this kind of big outside aluminium extension. It's just cool. I love it. I just love it. Covardis is great for a martini. You can't go wrong.
These
with
are really good tips.
Yeah, good. Thanks. I just love Soho. My studio's here, and I love to just nip out for an omelette at Zadel. Usually, it used to be, and I really like duck soup. So they have duck soup in Soho, which is always, always, always delicious. Just remember, like veggie fritters being spot on, and they have a little duck picklery in East London where I've been to buy like kombucha. They do like vinegars in a bottle that you then dilute with water, and then you feel kind of probiotic when you're drinking. But like, I like London, that part of what I love about it, we are spoiled. We have so many places that are like brand new and modern and trying to change the game. We have so many old school, stalwart, classic, farting about places. And I think what I find difficult when I go out into the rest of Britain especially is things feel much more designed for like taking a picture of the room, or but they feel much less authentic and much more constructed, and it's because
more contrived,
because we're so spoiled in London for anything we want. I'm like, well, this isn't what I would do. I would go completely classic. I'd go Rochelle Canteen. Like, so it's a bit of a like, yeah. I'm spoiled by this brilliant city that is full of like loads of fish and loads of sauce.
Ooh, I really want to go to Rochelle Canteen.
Do it.
Well, in total contrast to that,
yes.
The penultimate chapter, chapter 6, is your worst travel experience or the place you'd never go back to.
There's no, I I actually, I have written some, well, I had prepared to say that my worst travel experience is going through security every single time. Oh.
God,
the
yes,
problem I have is I'm like such a grumpy old man, because I'm really blessed and privileged. I travel a lot. People fly me places to write about them. I go to openings, you know, art festivals, Basels, whatever. It's brilliant. And I am a seasoned security man. I'm like, I'm not wearing it. Why would I be wearing a belt? Why would I not have my laptop already separated? And I think it's for me, it's not that I hate going through security. It's that I can't fathom how other people are still unable to move swiftly through it. I can't get understand it. It's been 20 years of 100 mil of liquid. What are you doing with your liter of Evian? How are we still here? It's been 20 years.
Oh, my God. Do you know what? It's actually talking about your men, like, actually, as a woman, this is more challenging for us.
Yes.
The problem is I know the rules have been in for 20 years, but there's just a lip gloss that's deep at the bottom of my handbag.
Yeah. And there was a point when I was traveling so much that I just had a plastic bag with decanted stuff that I left it on, in my travel bag. So I never, I was like, we're going, I'll top these all up before I go.
I thought you were going to say that you just had the plastic bag as a carry-on.
Yeah, I once actually went on a hand luggage only, and I had a portfolio of papers, and I just put pants in with it and then changed my pants and then flew back the next day. I was like, I don't need anything more than that. But of all the places that I found most difficult, I think Cuba was, I found it really tough. So we went just before whatever the handover was happening. It was so hard to do the simplest things. And I've never, Rich and I went on this Barbados holiday. We fell in love with the Caribbean. We were like, this is paradise. We've seen paradise. We've tasted it. And we've been on a few holidays where we've tried to chase that particular dragon and been like, this isn't Barbados. I didn't feel like people were trying to con me in Barbados. Like Cuba felt so, like, had so much red tape. For like, we need a car. And it was just like, why can't we just hire a car? Like, we just really felt that really acutely. It was stunning. It's a beautiful place to be. So it was a shame that we just had so much farting about with the car.
Yeah, I get that. So we're on to the final chapter of your travel diaries, Raven. Chapter 7 is the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list.
Really difficult. Really difficult. I'm going to say, I'm like the pressure. I'm going to say Hawaii. It's just so hard. It's just something about this kind of like volcanic island bubbling out of the sea feels really magic to me.
Talk about paradise islands.
So I've always had this dream of going there. My husband's like not too fussed, so I might go with my mates. But I just always had this dream of being there. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with Jurassic Park. And I've always had this sort of pipe dream of going to all the different places where they filmed it. Soaking it in.
That's a good dream.
Yeah.
I actually traveled quite a lot around Hawaii.
Yeah.
And it is, I feel like, having spoken to you and what you like, I think that it would live up to your expectations.
Very good. I just hope there's, I think it's like, I want kind of like grandiose scenery. Then I want like some old culture. Let's have a bit of that. And then it's like, and now we're going to the beach for a bit. And then I want a couple of days of like,
It will deliver on all fronts. Yeah. It will deliver on all fronts. A bit of a long flight.
Yeah. It's not a cheap one, is it? You can't really hitch. It's not like a fast swim. If I swim, no. And I also think for me, it's like nowadays, it's not that it's not about the destination. The destination is important, but actually, like we were saying at the top, it's about the amount of time I get to go away for. I want, like, for me, I'll go anywhere if it's for a month. I'm like, wait, I will go back to Brighton if it means that I'm not working for a month. There's something about sort of just being able to actually carve out the time. You know, I know people that take August off, and I'm just like, one of these years, I'm just going to not work in August. One of these years.
That's such a European thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
They nail that.
Yeah. So my parents have a house in the south of France, and they don't go in August because it's too hot, which is probably the most bougie thing they've ever done. And I just have this dream of being there in August and just eating brie. I mean, just like pottering around, being a villager for a month and just reading. You know, I went and worked there on one of my books for a little bit, and I was just reading till 1 o'clock and then going for a beer and then come back with some beers and doing some writing. I mean, that is the life.
That is truly the life. Yeah. I'm picturing it now, dreaming of it for you and for me.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Raven. Those were your travel diaries. It has been so fun chatting to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was the fabulous Raven Smith. His new book, Raven Smith's Men, is out now. Thanks so much for listening today. If you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you're using Apple Podcasts, to hit follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you're loving the podcast, it would be amazing if you could take a minute to leave a rating or a review on your podcast app. To find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. And if you can't wait till then, remember there's 6 seasons you can catch up on. Thanks again for tuning in, everyone, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.